Good morning. Greetings in the name of the one who has extended his mercy and his grace, but who also has called us to live lives of holiness. To me, he didn't just extend it and say, okay, that's all good, you can keep on. But he said, live up on a higher plane, come to a different place with my grace and my strength in your life. A few things here. You had a very good weekend in Berksville, Kentucky last weekend, and I just want to thank you all for your prayer and your support. And also, it probably affects me more directly if people don't do this than some, and that is I also want to thank you all for the Bible school offering. It's nice to know that people support that work in different ways, and sometimes, especially with a lot of expenses coming, some of us may be left hanging with some of those if they aren't covered, so I really appreciate your help as a church in that. Last Sunday, after the fellowship meal there in Kentucky, there was a few of them that got to having a talk. They were just visiting with each other about some people they knew and some drug problems that they've experienced there in the community. So how many of you here kind of know what it's usually termed as meth is? You familiar with that term? Looks like a lot. Kind of know something about it. No, it's I don't know. It'd be interesting to know what you would tell me about it. It's probably something that I would guess overwhelmingly we feel kind of negative about. Is that right? You feel kind of negative about it. Okay. Well, I want you to listen real closely. And that's off a side note. I forgot, boys, I was going to say something. I really appreciate your help there on the front bench. It sat a lot better with you there. So, okay, back to meth, of all things. It's generally known as methamphetamine. Is the big name for it. Now, listen to this. It come out of Wikipedia. And I did amend this a bit. If you read the Wikipedia, you'll know why. I don't think I changed the meaning. It says, in low doses, methamphetamine can elevate mood, increase alertness, concentration, and energy in fatigued individuals. It reduces appetite and promotes weight loss. So you think you're legitimate in your assumption of that it being negative? Well, let me keep going. At higher doses, it induces psychosis, whatever that is, a breakdown of skeletal muscle. It can produce seizures and bleeding in the brain. Chronic high dose use can precipitate unpredictable and rapid mood swings, stimulate psychosis, paranoia, hallucinations, delirium and delusions, and violent behavior. Recreationally, methamphetamine's ability to increase energy has been reported to lift mood and give superhuman energy. Methamphetamine is known to pose a high addiction risk, which basically means a high likelihood that long-term or high-dose use will lead to compulsive drug use, or in other words, you're no longer in control. High dependency liability, a high likelihood that withdrawal symptoms will occur when methamphetamine use ceases. Then it goes on and says, heavy recreational use of methamphetamine may lead to post-acute withdrawal syndrome, which can persist for months beyond the typical withdrawal period. Methamphetamine is toxic to the human brain and causes extensive damage. This damage includes adverse changes in the brain structure and function, such as reduction in gray matter volume in several brain regions and adverse changes in the ability of the brain to function. So I guess you were right, huh? Now, if you understood all that, I'm not sure if I did either, but it didn't sound good for the brain anyways, if I can bring that down a little narrower. Another thing interesting about methamphetamine, I don't know how many of you noticed that they're at the Walnut Ridge Courthouse where I have to do some paperwork occasionally. They used to, I didn't check, they used to have a poster there of what meth does to you. Have any of you ever seen that thing? Had a picture, I think it was before somebody was on it, and then I believe it was 3 years later. It wasn't just very long in years, really. And you would have not recognized the person. They went from being, I think that case, about a 20-year-old girl to looking like they were probably in their 60s or 70s, just teeth missing, cheeks sunken in, just horrible, okay? So that is basically what meth does to physical appearance. I can't imagine what it does to the brain. So let me just ask you a question. I think I know the answer, but is this something that the majority of you would be comfortable using? Is that something you'd be comfortable using? Okay, good. I appreciate that. So I don't have to ask you why or why not. I just read it. So let me ask you a question. You think if I'm useless, just hang in there a bit. Why do people use meth? Okay. Go ahead, I'm sorry. I was trying to cut
temporarily.
You. Okay, so basically it promises, they see the promise of energy, of being more stimulated, of, yeah. They see that promise, and so they use it in an effort to achieve something they want. But I think here we would all agree that the risk far, far outweighs the benefits of meth, right? I don't think we have a problem agreeing with that. You know, nobody that takes meth for the first time has any intention, could I say, of ending up like the person in the poster at the Walnut Ridge Courthouse. That is the last thing on their minds. Well, last thing. They are going to be in control of this thing. Yet invariably, meth users find that it controls them. I have, my neighbor was telling me, oh, this has been a little while ago, of a man who was general manager of a service and parts department in one of the bigger dealerships north of here. I guess I won't name it. And this man had a very hectic schedule. And he had some workmen that evidently used some of this stuff. And so they were always saying, you know, he's tired. He just couldn't keep up. And so they would get offered this and get offered this. Finally, he took some. Oh, and he could work so much better. He just worked hyperactivity. But guess what? He still lost his job. In fact, he didn't do a very good job at his job after he started with this. So now I realize this is not a drug rehab thing, so I'm not necessarily, I don't have any fears of you using meth, in case you're wondering. But I want you to think about this a bit. And I'm going to ask you a question that maybe you won't like on the surface. But that is, are you very different from a meth user? And I'm going to spend the rest of the time telling you why I ask you that question. My subject this morning is the deceit of sin. And I preach this message because, well, maybe this is a message born out of frustration with myself. Let me ask you this way. How many of you enjoy being deliberately deceived? You just get a big kick out of it. Somebody just lies to you. Just point blank lies. I think I know the answer there as well. I don't enjoy it, and I think the rest of you join me in that. And again, how many of us like just empty promises? Empty promises. Somebody says, oh yeah, I'll do that. Makes me think of this one story. I think that was the vet, James Harriet. Remember that man? I don't know if those of you that have ever read or listened to those books about the vet, or I mean the farmer that would say he will guarantee he fixes that gate. And years later, he'd come back, and here was his dreadful gate still right there, falling over on top of him and knocking him over. And you know, finally, James did not want empty promises. He wanted a fixed gate. He could care less whether this fellow guaranteed gates. What did it matter? He wanted a fixed gate. I'm the same way. How many of you continue to do business with a person or company who continuously promises but never delivers on their commitment? So you order something. Oh, yeah, you get an email saying, we are shipping this today. Yet a week later, you get another one saying, we're shipping this today. I'm sorry, we didn't get it out. And a month later, we still haven't shipped it. You know, you'd pretty soon decide it's time to request a refund. How would you feel about a company that would have such a slick marketing department that people would buy their products, yet their products would not deliver at all? Now, I know we like to be a bit contentious on this one, right? Sometimes we have brands we like and we say, the other person's brand name that they use, a phone, a truck, whatever, that's just slick marketing. Well, that may be true. At the same time, I think most of our phones still call out, right? Regardless of the brand name stamped on them. Most of our trucks at least drive down the road some of the time, regardless of the emblem on the front. I don't know about ladies what they argue about for sure. Maybe they don't. They're probably taught not to argue. But you know, if there was a phone company that made a phone that was just a dummy, it didn't even start up, you could not call, you couldn't text, you couldn't do anything with it, and yet people would stand in line to buy this phone, you would say, oh, they're crazy, right? If there was a truck, and I know Apple and Ford have been accused of doing some of this, but if there was a truck that would absolutely not drive, it wouldn't even start up, it would look like a nice truck, you could set it in your driveway and impress all your friends, but as long as you didn't ever have to do anything with it, we'd say you're stupid. I mean, forget it. I mean, what good is it, right? Now I want to ask you a question, maybe I should ask it myself. Why do we, or should I say, why do I buy into the promises of sin? Maybe you don't. I'd like for you to open your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3, and we'll read 7 to 19. I think I found a few messages in here, but we'll focus on one. So why is it when it comes to sin, I struggle to doubt the validity of what it offers? Maybe you don't, but again, I do. And that's partially where this message comes from, is a frustration that's born out of that. And then also an article I read that I'll come to in a while later. So Hebrews chapter 3, verse 7. I decided to just read the whole context here, even though I won't necessarily be focusing on a lot of these verses. But he's taking Israel back to the time that Israel was there in the desert. And he refers to that. Hebrews 3, verse 7. Wherefore, as the Holy Ghost saith, today if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts, as in the provocation, in the day of temptation, in the wilderness, when your fathers tempted me, proved me, and saw my works for 40 years. Wherefore was I grieved with that generation, and said, they do always err in their heart. They have not known my ways. So I swear in my wrath, they shall not enter into my rest. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you should be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we are made partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast unto the end. While it is said, today if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts as in the provocation. For some, when they had heard, did provoke, howbeit not all that came out of Egypt by Moses. For with whom was he grieved 40 years? Was it not with them that had sinned, whose carcasses fell in the wilderness, or those who believed the lie of sin? And to whom swear he that they should not enter into his rest, but to them that believed not? So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. If you want to, you can turn to Judges chapter 13 and keep me on the straight and narrow here. I won't read a lot of this, but that's where some of the rest of this will come from. One thing I want to point out back in verse 12 and 13, he says, take heed, brethren. Whoever wrote Hebrews here is not talking to the sinners out there, to the meth users, to the one that do not know God. He is talking to brethren and sisters, people that have known God and are claiming to serve God. But he says, take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God, but exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you should be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. So that's what I want to talk about, is the deceitfulness of sin. If we go back to Judges chapter 13, we have a bit of a unique story about a young man. And maybe I associate with it because it was a young man. And now I know for some of you, as you listen to me tell this story, you're going to say, well, Judges 14 verse 4 says, but his father and his mother knew not that it was of the Lord that he sought occasion against the Philistines. So you're going to maybe say, well, Samson had his problems, but really it was of God that he got involved in that. I guess I'd beg to disagree. In Genesis, we're also told that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Yet we're also very clearly told that each person has an individual choice to make. So the way I look at this, and the reason I will use this story the way I will this morning, is because God used Samson in spite of the choices he made. I think God had a better plan for Samson, a nicer plan for Samson. But Samson took this way, so God still used him. God's purposes were not thwarted, but for Samson, there was an awful reaping. So anyway, going to Judges chapter 13, we basically have a couple who didn't have children. And I'm not sure where the wife was. The one time they were in the field, I'm not know if she was the first time, but she meets this man that tells her that she's going to have a child, and because this child is going to be something special, she's supposed to stay away from wine and so on and so on. And so the woman comes to her husband and tells him, you know, a man came and he told me I'm going to have a baby, and he told me these things. Well, the man, he seemed to wanted to know directly about these regulations, I guess I'll call them. So he prayed and asked that this man could come again, and sure enough, here this man shows up to this woman again. She runs and fetches her husband. He's still there. He basically repeats his instructions. The man asks a few questions, really not that many. Then they offer a sacrifice, and this man, actually an angel, goes up in the smoke of their sacrifice. Well, a while later, we have this baby is born. And his parents name him Samson. And in verse 24 of chapter 13, It says, Samson the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. So that's where we are when we come to Samson in Judges chapter 14. Now here the story begins to change a bit. We now have an adult Samson, I'm going to call him. And the adult Samson starts showing some things that are not that different from what I've showed in my life. So we have the adult Samson went down, verse 1 of chapter 14, and Samson went down to Timnath, and he saw a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. And he came up and told his father and his mother and said, I've seen a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore get her for me to wife. And his father and his mother said unto him, is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren or among all thy people that thou goest to take a wife of the uncircumcised Philistines? And Samson said unto his father, get her for me, for she pleaseth me well. Okay, so we have three chapters of the Bible devoted almost exclusively, actually I should say four, 13 through 16, to this man and his life. But in verse 3 there, Samson sets the tone for most of the rest of his life. He tells his mom and his dad, he did like all the young fellows, I did my share of it, like some of these still do. He took a trip, let's say, and he went down there and he saw this girl. Ha, that's the one I want for my wife. So he comes back home. And rather than broaching this respectfully, he tells mom, dad, you know, I saw the one for me, and you get her for me. Get her for me. Entitlement. It's about me. It's about what I want. It's about myself and I. Self. Self-pity, self-centeredness, self-absorption. Self is the root from which all sin sprouts. May I say that? It is the handle by which temptations grip us. Without self, and I'd love to be corrected if I'm wrong, but as I thought about this, without self, our enemy would have no hold on us or way to tempt us, I don't think. If I wouldn't have any self left in my life, do you think there'd be any way for me to face temptation? I don't think so. How could you tempt the fellow that doesn't have self? So that's how Samson started his life as a young man. So in chapter 14, verse 7, we have Samson again going. It says he's traveling again. And he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. Okay. So now Samson is exactly the same shape that Eve was when she looked at the fruit, that Adam was when he looked at Eve. He looked, he desired, he sought what pleased himself. When we focus on ourselves and what we would like to have, we automatically become what Samson did in verse 9. Let's just read 8 and 9. And after a time, he returned to take her, and he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. He'd killed this lion. And behold, there was a swarm of bees and honey in the carcass of the lion. And he took thereof in his hands and went eating and came to his father and mother and gave to them, and they did eat. Now, if we were going back to chapter 13, Samson's mom was told not to get in contact with any dead body. And that was before he was even born. So now we have Samson deliberately not only touching a dead body, but actually eating honey out of a dead body. So what had Samson become? He'd become lax in obedience. Lax in obedience. You know, when I live for self, I become casual and have a careless attitude about God, about his desire for me, and the commands he has given to me. After all, how can I consider God when all my thoughts are about myself? It's impossible. This in turn leads to verses 18 and 19 in chapter 14. So we now have Samson getting married, however this all went. And we have him putting out this riddle about the lion. And we have his wife begging and begging and pleading and just pestering him till he says that, I think he says his life isn't worth living, basically, in my own words. Then in verse 18 and 19, she finally gets this out of him. And so she right away goes and passes it on to the friends, the one that he had made this deal with. And so they come and give him the answer. As Samson gets angry in verse 18, he says, if ye had not plowed with my heifer, the last part of 18, or with my wife, ye had not found out my riddle. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon and slew 30 men of them, and took of their spoil, and gave the change of garments unto them which expounded the riddle. And his anger was kindled, and he went up to his father's house. That marriage didn't last long at all, did it? So there goes Samson, angry and frustrated at being used, at being abused, he thought. Yet you know what? Samson failed one vital thing. And that is that Samson blamed these other fellows and his wife for his problems. He never stopped long enough to realize that Samson was causing all of Samson's problems. I say all of, really technically. I guess the others were and had a role they played in there. So he became angry and frustrated, yet he denied the real cause of his problems. This cause is misdirected energy. When we get angry and frustrated, yet we're unwilling to accept personal responsibility. It causes misdirected energy. He's now upset at what happened, but he's still living in this bubble, this greenhouse of the lie. It's other people's fault. I'll teach them a thing or two, was kind of how his mind ran. And this in turn leads, strangely enough to me, to him becoming defensive about the very people that had damaged him. Now, how weird is that? That's in 15 verse 7. So we have Samson going home in a rage because of what these fellows and his wife had done to him. Then in chapter 15, verse 7, he catches these 300 foxes. He must have been quite a trap or something, and he ties them up, and he lights their tails, and they run through the fields and burn the things down, and the Philistines say, "What is going on here?" And they say, "Oh, Samson's mad. His wife got the riddle, and she passed it on." So the Philistines' ways of dealing with this problem was to go up to Samson's ex-wife, I guess, and her dad, and they burned him with fire. Quite the solution they have going on here. And then Samson, all of a sudden now, he's no longer angry, I guess, at his wife, because in verse 7 he says, "And Samson said unto them," this is the Philistines, "though ye have done this, yet will I avenge you, and after that I will cease." All right, now he's defensive about the very thing that was taking him down. This cycle of selfishness, pride, denial, and bitterness leads to the next step, which we find in chapter 16, verse 1. Judges chapter 16, verse 1. "And then went Samson to Gaza and saw there a harlot and went in unto her." So now we have a man with no self-control. We have a man who has totally lost, a total loss of self-restraint. He just saw and he went in. There was no waiting period, no trying to work things out. Just a fallen man. This also put him on the path of playing with fire, which is what we find in most of the rest of this chapter. I don't know. I call it Samson playing with fire. Or maybe you could call it Samson's dance with death. Verse 4. "And it came to pass afterward that he loved the woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah." And then we have the lords of the Philistines, the rulers coming and telling Delilah, "You know, if you really find out why this fellow is so invincible, we'll each give you, 1,000 pieces of silver or something? So you entice him, you figure out what is going on here, and we'll pay you." Wow, Samson is getting in deep waters. We could go to verse 10 and 11. So Samson makes a joke out of it. He tells her, "If you do this, if you bind me with green twigs," I think was the first one, "then I'll be just like regular people." Well, that didn't work at all. In verse 10, "Delilah said unto Samson, Behold, thou hast mocked me and told me lies. Now tell me, I pray thee, wherewith mightest thou be bound?" And then he goes on and tells another joke or fib. "They bind me fast with new ropes that were never occupied or used. Then I shall be weak as another man." Now, what in the world is Samson doing? Is he crazy? I mean, here he could see as clear as day what Delilah's intention towards him was. There was absolutely no question where Delilah's affections and loyalty were. She was going to tie him up, come what may, any way she could, to get him turned over, okay? So it was totally clear and evident what Delilah was trying to do, yet Samson kept right on playing this deadly game. He went back again and again and yet again. And then of all the crazy things, he ends up by telling her the truth of his strength. Now, I don't know about you, but as I look at Samson in this story, He looks like a deranged person. I don't know. Why in the world, when you know that somebody has taken deliberate action 3 times to have you killed, you would turn around and actually give them the truth of what is protecting you? But that's what he did. It made me think of Proverbs chapter 7, verse 21 and 23. You see if you agree. Proverbs chapter 7, verse 21 and 23, talking about the woman who caught the young man that didn't know what he was doing there. It says, with her much fair speech, she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips, she forced him. He goeth after her straightway, as an ox goeth to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hasteth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life. If we go on to chapter 16, verse 20, we have Samson, after he told her the secret, he was there sleeping. His hair is now cut, his strength is gone. Delilah hollers again for the 4th time. The Philistines be upon thee, Samson. And he awoke out of his sleep and said, and this is what he said, I will go out as at other times before and shake myself. Samson had become totally detached from the reality and the truth of his actions. Samson had actually got to the place where I think it was all about him. And I really don't think he believed that his strength would actually leave. Because he says, I'll go out of the other. That's no big deal. I'm still in control of the situation. Yeah, I kind of pushed the boundaries, but it's still working out. Let's finish verse 20. I will go out as at other times before and shake myself. And he wist not that the Lord was departed from him. Samson had become so self-absorbed, so occupied with himself, his game, his control, his whatever you want to call it, that he was not even aware when God was no longer in his life. Like I said, it's almost easy for me to sit here and what was wrong with Samson? What kind of mental problems would we say he had today if we sent him to a psychiatrist? But really, is what was wrong with Samson sometimes wrong with me? Am I so much different from Samson? Are you so much better than Samson? Okay, I don't want to embarrass anybody, so I'm going to let you tell me. But let's have a few brave people tell us what you struggle with in your life. Anyone. Don't have to be very specific, can be general. But let's have three or four. What's something you struggle with in your life? Anger? Thank you. Some more?
Pride.
Thank you. At least one more.
Jealousy.
Jealousy. Anybody want to add another one?
Self-control.
Okay. Now, I don't know how you mean this self-control. We can spin that one 2 ways. I guess we could say you have difficulty controlling yourself as in being self-disciplined, or you could have tried to be in control of yourself when you need to be in control of God. So I don't know if you want to clarify that, you may, or I can go with it this way. Just if I take it different from what you meant it, and no offense there. Okay, so these are struggles. I would say probably all of us have to some degree. Anger, pride, jealousy. I'm going to do this, I hope you don't mind, Dina, but a desire to be in control is how I'm going to do this. Now, I would say that probably some of us have maybe more specific struggles. Maybe some face anger a little harder. Maybe some pride a little bit more. Maybe some do face jealousy more because of the circumstances. And maybe some of us do desire, maybe I'll just change that so I don't run over myself. Maybe some of us do struggle more with trusting others and a desire for control. Desire for control. But you know, all of those are very real. There's something I have faced, I think all 4. I don't know if everybody here has or not. But let's just think about anger for a bit. I don't want anybody to feel put on the spot, but why do people get angry? Why do you get angry? Think about yourself. For me, I'll talk about myself, I guess that's safe. For me, anger generally stems from frustration. Actually, we could almost tie it into the thing of a desire for control. For me, I don't know, maybe it's different in your life. But it's when things are not going my way. And if that phone rings one more time, there's one more door that breaks, or one more truck that doesn't start, or whatever it is, I am going to fly off the handle because it's just not going. I mean, I was supposed to have a good day. I woke up excited about the week, and now it's just trashed. And so I get angry as, well, it just feels logical, doesn't it? It starts logical. I know one man, they said he'd be in the garage, and if something didn't fix the way he thought it should fix, pretty soon his wrenches would be sailing out across the road. That really fixes a problem fast, doesn't it? Well, we know it don't, but somehow it just, oh, feels good, huh? What does it? Is that so different from Samson? Think. Oh, that's just our response. It's how we respond to what we're insured is. But you see, what's it gaining us? What's it doing for us? That temptation to anger does really absolutely nothing to fix your frustrations. And I've found when I just stop myself, I feel that frustration, I just stop myself by the grace of God. Take a couple deep breaths, maybe pray for a while. And I say, God, I have no idea why this day has to look like this to me. But you know what? I'm going to be thankful anyway. I want to tell you a secret I've found. Maybe you found it too. I hope so. That all of a sudden, the day actually goes a lot better. It's not that my problems evaporate. But now, rather than my problems controlling me, I've given them to a God that controls my problems. Okay, let's look at the other one. Pride. If there's almost a universal sin, it's pride, probably, too. As different shapes and aspects. And yeah, I'm not saying we all face that one the same way. Same time, I have yet to know anybody really, really well that didn't have pride in some way. And when I mean pride, I'm not talking often, and I know I don't want to bore you. At the same time, I'm going to remind you, pride is not so much feeling better than others, but it's just an improper view of myself, be that good or bad. That's pride, how I define pride. So why do we become proud? Isn't it all because we want some value? We want to feel like somebody? Isn't it because I want to be worth something after all? I've spent how many years on this earth, and I've accomplished something, surely. It's not wrong to, you know, at least know that I'm good for something. But really, what gives me value? Can there be any value claimed outside of the shed blood of Christ? So doesn't pride really come down into, years ago I was having maybe too much of an argument with a man about eternal security. And he got angry. He got really angry with his way of winning the argument. So he told me to bend over and get a hold of my boots and pull myself off the ground. Well, pride, trying to find personal worth through being proud, is the same thing. You're getting a hold of yourself and trying to elevate yourself by pulling on your own boots. And it's the greatest effort and futility. But it feels pretty good, doesn't it? Because after all, I compare myself among myself, and I'm better than that person at least. And whew, maybe I'll pass that person up. Who knows? Really? When you live your life in pride, it ends up kind of being disgusting, doesn't it? Jealousy. Oh, jealousy. That thing of wishing I had what others have. Really, essence, jealousy is, at least in my studies, has been of wishing ill against others so that I either look better or can have what they have. That's no good, is it? Yet, I struggle with it at times. Why? Doesn't it come back into, again, me wanting to be somebody? This comparison thing? The desire for control. Why is that a problem? I kind of covered that in anger, didn't I? I want to be in control. I want to set my schedule. I want to spend my money the way I want to spend it. Just control, control. Let me ask you one question. Can a Christian be in control of his life? I don't think so. I think there's somebody else in control of a Christian's life. But oh, it's a struggle to give up that control, isn't it? It feels so vulnerable, so scary. But really, you can't get anywhere as long as you're controlling your life. Because finally, you will get angry and frustrated, and throwing your wrenches out across the road into the ditch doesn't fix that truck, and it doesn't fix your life. So are you, I'll just let you ask yourself that, are you smarter and wiser than Samson in the battles you face? Are you actually pretty much like Samson in the way you're facing him? And you know, facing these battles always follows a cycle. I'll just erase this. Sin always follows a cycle, and it follows this cycle of, so we have sin. So a big part of the temptation in sin is, can we say the promise that sin makes? Maybe I'll just use anger. The promise that sin makes in relation to anger is, if you just fly off the handle and you tell this person once and for all what you think about him, they might get out of my way and let me go on with my life. That's the promise of sin. Promise of sin in anger is that this will somehow fix it. It will somehow make me feel better. It will somehow take care of what I'm facing. That is the promise of sin. So that leads us to anger or whatever other sin that you want to list. Well, what happens when you indulge in anger? So the next step is indulgence. So now, and I'm not trying to pick on anger. There's many sins just as bad or worse than anger, but I'm going to keep going. So now I indulge in anger. Now I just get red in the face. I roar and I shout and I throw and I do whatever. Damage feelings and relationships. When I indulge, what is the end result of indulgence? A good, happy, thankful feeling, right? Hasn't been in my experience. Not at all. It brings a terrible empty. Can I call emptiness? I don't know what good word is. Just nothing. Just this terrible regret. This terrible wishing, oh, why didn't I control myself? Why did I do this again? Why was I tempted? Well, what happens when we're empty? How did Paul say? I know that is in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. So when you look inside and you don't see anything, what is the next temptation? I think it's to indulge even more. Unless you find God somewhere in this cycle, your next thing is more indulgence. Maybe in other things. This is why, and I say this carefully, I don't want you to prejudge or anything, but if somebody has a severe anger problem, has a severe any kind of problem, they almost always have some other problems along with it. You can't stop anger and say, oh, this doesn't flow over. It does. It does. It flows over. How did one fellow that I appreciate his teaching a lot, I forget exactly who that was now, though. There's a couple possible ones. But he said it this way. He said, sin loves company. If you're an angry person, you've got other sin in your life that you probably aren't owning up to generally. Now, that's not saying that when you repent of all sin, that anger just goes away. I realize that. So if you're fighting the battle, God be with you, and I'm not trying to add stuff on you. But generally, it's more indulgence. I became angry, so I feel empty. I feel helpless. I feel useless. So now I look around. What other way could I find some self-worth? Maybe it's moral failure. Maybe it's some area of pride. Maybe it's some area of spending more money than what I have. I don't know how many of you remember this, but Aaron, what's the one that did the financial things? Aaron something. Aaron Lapp Jr. You remember when he was here? He said something about how people in bad financial trouble just go out and spend a lot of money sometimes. Well, that's what they're doing. They feel empty. They feel bad. So they're trying to find some way to feel good. More indulgence. The next step on this road is bondage. Bondage. So now you're no longer in control. No matter what you say, no matter what you think, you come back and your response is anger. Whenever things don't go the way you want them, you're angry. When other people doubt you, you become angry. You are in bondage to anger. And of course, the last one, and I want to say this carefully, outside of repentance and God's help is death. And I'm, of course, referring to spiritual death, but often it's followed not too far behind by actually physical death. The deceit of sin. It promises ever so much. It delivers something so very different from what it had promised. It promises fulfillment. It delivers disappointment. It promises happiness, a way out, a way to feel good. It delivers shame and sorrow and only digs your pit deeper and deeper. It promises to make you feel valuable and full. It delivers worthlessness and a hollow, gaping emptiness. It promises little or no consequence. You can hide it. It won't be that big of a deal. It delivers life-shattering, breath-crushing results. It promises you can stop whenever you want to or choose to, but it delivers uncontrollable appetites and passions. And maybe the biggest lie of all is it promises that if you only indulged a little bit more, if you had more of the same, if you you would truly experience an awesome result if you went just a little bit further down this path. But it delivers an endless aching cycle of never achieving what you truly desire. That's the promises of sin, and that's the delivery of sin. The more you have or do, the more you need. The more you need, the more you try or do. The promises of sin are a total impossibility, a fantasy, a myth, a lie. How many of you have seen a hamster already in a cage? So did the one you see have that little wheel?
You know what I'm talking about? That little plastic wheel or metal wheel?
Okay.
Can a hamster get from here to California by running on that wheel? How many think he can?
Not one person.
I've seen some hamsters really run on that wheel. Are you really telling me that there's absolutely no way for him to get anywhere just by running as fast as he can?
Sure,
he can run as fast as he wants to.
He can spin that thing at, I don't know how fast a hamster could make that wheel spin. But just as fast as the fastest hamster could ever make that wheel spin. And it would get him absolutely nowhere. I think I've used this here before, but maybe it's long enough. You'll excuse me for using it again. If somebody would have put enough salt in here, made me salt water to drink. It's actually better in the ocean because I can always quit here if it tastes salty. But if you're out in the ocean, in a lifeboat or something, let's say, I guess it was just this week, wasn't it, that some two ladies that have been sailing around the world with their dog were found. I forget how many, at least 3 months that they were lost. So let's say they're out there, they run out of drinking water, and they have no way of separating salt from the ocean water. What happens to a person that drinks salt water? Does anybody want to tell me? Right, when you drink salt water, what really happens is that you add salt to your bloodstream. When you add salt to your bloodstream, your body demands more water to get rid of that excess salt, which in turn makes you thirstier. So you have to drink even more water to try, your body demands more water to get rid of the salt. Well, with the result that if all you have is salt water, you drink ever-increasing quantities of salt water in an effort to quench your thirst, with the result that you will actually, you can die from the salt content, but oftentimes they will die simply from drinking so much that it kills them. Because no matter how much ocean water you drink, it will never satisfy your thirst. No matter how fast that hamster spins its wheel, it will go absolutely no further than a couple inches. And you know, if we're trying to solve, if we're letting sin deceive us, if we're accepting the deception of sin, we're that hamster running endlessly on a wheel. We are that man or woman trying to satisfy thirst by drinking salt water. That brings me back to the warning that I read in Hebrews chapter 3, verse 13. Lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. You know, one definition of insanity is to continue doing the same thing while expecting different results. Why do I believe the deception of sin? Why do I think that I can indulge in sin, I can follow sin, and somehow its promise is going to end up differently than it did before? Every last one of us that is old enough to really know what sin is knows exactly the feeling that comes over us when we indulge in sin, don't we? Does it get you somewhere? Does it bring you closer to victory? Does it bring you more peace and happiness? I'm going to tell you, for me, it absolutely has not. It's done the opposite. The more I do, the thirstier I get. The more I drink, the more I need. And that, dear friends, is what it means to be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. Now, when I sit back and I look at Samson, I distance myself. I say, what is wrong with Samson? But you know what's wrong with Samson is pretty much wrong with Joe as well. I believe a lie. And as long as I believe that lie, I cannot get anywhere in my Christian life. Because I'm trying to solve something that can't be solved without realizing what the lie is. And you know, you would think that somebody living in sin would sooner or later see, oh, this isn't working. I better find a different way. But the fact is, that won't happen unless you're willing to sacrifice a lie. And the longer you live in the lie, the harder it becomes to acknowledge the lie you're living in. 4 steps in keeping sin from deceiving me, and these are for myself. The first one is, know sin as deceitful. Now, maybe you think that's a funny way of wording it. Know sin as deceitful. The reason I said know sin rather than feel sin or see sin as deceitful is I, as a human being, with my limited vision, with my body, the flesh, that desires wrong things, there is many times I do not see or feel that sin is deceitful. It is almost impossible at times for me, I don't know how it is for you, but in my flesh, to not see anger sometimes as a solution, to not see jealousy sometimes as a solution, to not see whatever we're facing, as sometimes it just looks so enticing. It looks like it would so easily fix whatever I'm facing. So I will not necessarily feel it. When I, by the grace of God, don't get angry, it's not because I feel so strongly that anger is wrong, but it is because I know, by the grace of God, I can know and be committed that it is wrong. It has to be based on concrete fact, not my feelings. The second one is, see God for who he is. And then this is another one I know I beat around on recently. But to see God, to truly see God, to ask God to truly help you see him, is the only way to true humility and brokenness. We try so hard sometimes to become broken or to have a humble spirit. But you know, outside of seeing God, his awesomeness, his mercy, like we heard, and also his holiness, there is no way on earth I will ever really become broken or humble. I have to see God. The third in that is to cry out to God in repentance and ask for his help in the battle. You know, quite frankly, we just cannot do it. And again, I know this touches on other subjects. You know, so often we're like this person with this backpack or whatever, this package full of rocks, all our problems. And we think the Christian life is to strap this thing on our back and stagger down that straight and narrow road. It doesn't work. We fall over time after time. You know where the real battle is? It's just in giving up all control to the only one who can carry the load that my sin has put upon me. The number 4, live your life based on the facts of faith. Notice what I said. Live your life based on the facts of faith and in commitment to the truth. No amount of feeling, no amount of emotion will be strong enough or consistent enough to keep me living for Christ. How many of you read the back of the Companions? I think it was last week. Robert Stauffer's guest editorial. Any of you read that? Okay, I don't mind if you would, it wouldn't hurt to hear it again. I did amend and abridge this, so if you want to read the original version, go do that. But this stood out to me so much in what I was needing this week. He says this, one of my married sons, and again, I did abridge this and adapt it a bit. One of my married sons experienced ungodly chatter many times in a place where he was employed. The men would joke about the fun they had getting drunk. They would ask my son, Jonathan, have you ever got drunk? When he replied in the negative, they would tell him, you must have lived a very sheltered life. Other times, when they talked about their experiments with illegal drugs, their close calls with the law, and even boasted about their impure living. One man especially hounded my son about his sheltered life. He told him, you must not have had much fun in life. He asked Jonathan point blank, "So when did you become a man?" Jonathan, knowing what he meant, quietly replied, "After I got married." The man shook his head again and remarked about all the fun that he had missed. At that moment, God gave Jonathan an answer for his coworker. Jonathan told his coworker this. He said, "You know, I have never experienced waking up with a hangover. I never have to worry that what I might have done while I was drunk or stoned. I enjoy the God-given intimacy that was ordained only for and in marriage, so I have never needed to be concerned that I would get a disease that comes through impure living. I never must worry about fathering a child outside of marriage and paying the accompanying child support. I've never needed to worry about what would show up in a drug test. I have a clean record with the law and do not have to worry when being checked. Now I want to ask you a question. Tell me, sir, am I missing so very much?" The man did not have to think long. Even he admitted, "You are not missing anything at all that is truly worthwhile." And he said unto them, Christ, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. Whosoever will lose his life for my sake, the same shall save it." Let's kneel for prayer.